all of you know what I'm talking about, if I can find the words to express it, that in each thing that is, there is running through it a thread that not only holds it in being, in existence, but pulls it forward towards the future, if you will, causing it to unfold itself, to develop, just as a flower begins with the seed in the earth, and the seed breaks open, it germinates, it puts out its little sprout, the sprout comes up. At first, all is immature, all is juvenile, all is undeveloped. But as it grows, not only does it grow thicker, not only does it grow higher, but it begins to differentiate different parts of that sprout. Such that some becomes a leaf, and some becomes more thick, and some becomes... It goes through stages. The overriding aim of the flower, as it's finally produced before us, was in the seed. What it was to be was already potentially present. It required only the proper conditions of moisture and warmth, only the sun and the rain, and it became a flower. Now, you can say, well, what has this got to do with good? The good of the seed is the flower. Evil would have to be understood as anything that prevented the full development of that flower. Evil is scarcity, if you will, and lack in this sense. Scarcity of water, a lack of sunshine, a lack of opportunity. If a seed lies on the mantelpiece instead of in the earth, we cannot expect it to go through its full stages of development. There is something in that seed, as there was something in the flower that produced that seed, that drives it on to produce more flower, to become itself, to grow. Well, it's more complex, of course, on an organic level of animal life and of man. And yet what Aristotle said holds true not only for the flower, it holds true not only for a beast and for man, who also has, as it were, the potential plan within himself that, if fulfilled, brings, if I can use words loosely, happiness, fulfillment, satisfaction, goodness. But this same inner driving aim, this overriding idea, this is present in the stones of the earth, it is present in the grains of sand on the beach, it is present in the waters of the sea, it is present in everything that is. And each thing's goodness and the goodness of the entire created order, the entire universe, finally has something to do, rather basically to do, with the development and the fulfillment of everything to its most expansive point. Plato, who was earlier by a little than Aristotle and was not as taken with the biological model, Aristotle is the father of biology as well as the father of a good many of the sciences. Plato also had a conception of the inner driving aim of the good. And these things are more than just illustrations of how men have thought about the good. They have preeminently affected the Christian church's idea about goodness and evil. In Plato, the inner driving urge or aim is also present, but it is described as being the soul. And there is in Plato a dualism, or at least there is a bifurcation of man into two parts, into his body and his soul, that you do not find in Aristotle. In Aristotle, the soul of man is the form that man takes, just as the soul of the flower is its form. And they are not to be differentiated, they are not to be separated. And if I can go back for a moment to the flower image, when the flower has expressed itself, of course, it has not gone completely through all of its cycles of evolution. For the moment it reaches its full expansion, and we would say its full beauty, it begins inevitably to go backwards again to the ground. First it hardens, it dries, it becomes brittle, it curls, perhaps it closes. the leaves fall, the seeds, which are the guarantee of the immortality of the species, fall again into the earth, but that plant perishes. And its perishing is its true aim, too. It has fulfilled itself. And the same thing is true of the beast, it is true of the stars, it's true of man, according to Aristotle. But in Plato, it is not so. In Plato, the vision is made between the spiritual or soul part of man and his physical underpinning, his body. And there, the inner driving urge that carries a man forward, or carries anything that has soul forward, is the lure of this soul, which is not to be explained and is not reducible to the physical world, to the physical body. You can't explain it by the physical world. The inner driving aim of a man or of a flower or of anything else is for the spiritual part to leave this prison or this place of lesser good here in the physical world and to go again to the spiritual realm, which ultimately, at least in some of Plato's dialogues, we might say, would be the abode of God. That which carries a man through his life, that which causes him not only to grow by necessity, but to want to grow and to feel the evil effects of being held back, of being frustrated, of being unfulfilled, of being unsatisfied, that which drives him along on every dimension of his being, be it physical or psychological or what have you, that which lures him along is the attraction of his soul. And again, this is not necessarily Platonic, but it is at least part of Plato. It's drawing him towards God. You can easily see why the Christian tradition could use this and did. What is man's good? Man's chief good, the highest good, is that towards which all things aim, including self-fulfillment, self-development, the intellectos, or the overarching drive to become what we are or can be. But beyond that, that the soul might have enosis, unity, union, fellowship with God. Now, this may be a very speculative way of describing good, and yet ultimately all of our pragmatic and practical ways fail. They simply become lost in relativity, although relativity is the single factor that we have to take account in the world in which we live. But they lack any overarching explanatory power or any satisfying power if they're not hinged onto something like this as a general theory of good. In Christianity, of course, the Platonic conception of the soul as being immortal, as over against Aristotle's conception of the soul as being a function of the organism, you know, being the form of man, being man, and therefore being exhausted, finished, completed at a man's death. This was rejected, and the idea that the soul was deathless was taken over because it fitted, although it does not fit perfectly by any means, but it fitted better with the Christian conception of an eternal life. But good was then seen, ultimately, as God. But why God? It may seem like a strange question. And sometimes when we are treated to sermons and to teaching or exhortation on the basis of seeking God as our highest good, I wonder if we don't really think this. Why God? Particularly when it's put in an almost parodic way, a comic Platonic way of separating this world and whatever other worlds there might be, so that our good is to be considered as out yonder or then in some future time. The enemies of religion long ago, I think, outflanked all of us by saying, pie in the sky by and by. And we wonder then, why God? Can this really be explanatory? The kind of problem, in a way, which the poet brought up here. My life, he said, is spent in your service, and yet my roots are dry. I am time's eunuch. And apparently other people who are not so concerned with this overarching drive towards God are happier. They participate in the good, one might say, more than I. What is the explanation? Why, God? Why don't you send my return? I don't think if we look into the tradition itself, we will find that this general situation, which I've of course exaggerated, is tenable. There is, to be sure, in the Christian tradition, futurity. There is the lure, if you will, and there is always the goal of the life that is unending, if you will, and these are all symbols, the eternal life. There is a conception of God as the highest good. But what must be seen is this, that in the traditional theological formulations, it was Aristotle rather than Plato that was taken as a model on everything but this business of immortality. And in the tradition, although it may be one thing to write something in a book and another to live it and still another to teach it and still another to be understood, always there was considered that the road that leads to God leads through this world. It does not jump over it. Always the idea was that not that God is his highest good, but that he is our highest good, and that this inner driving urge would carry us through this world, and indeed through this world with the express purpose of achieving as much of good in a lesser and more relative sense as possible. Someone has said that we could sum up Jesus' biography in a few words. He went about doing good. Now, that may leave a great deal to be desired, but it certainly isn't untrue. And the life of all of those people, which the other night Dr. Christensen treated us to a minute or so with each of a number of heroes, both Christian and unchristian, what could we say about each of them but that they went about doing good? Now, their ideas of good probably varied. He mentioned Gandhi. He mentioned Francis. He mentioned Jesus and Tom Dooley and a number of others. But if we will look deeply, I think we will see that the conception of good that empowered all of them, and I use that word advisedly, empowered, not just inspired, but the conception which lured and drew them on, towards which they were driving, always had something close to do with life and its fulfillment. And that against which they struggled, be it by the word or by an action, be it by medical means or by hoping to reshape society, always that against which they struggled, which if they were philosophically inclined, or just like to use big words, they would call the problem of evil, was that which limited, frustrated, that which left human life unfulfilled, that which on every level and every dimension of life bore down upon the little thread that carries us through time. In some sense, the more spiritual, the more biological. I've talked quite enough. But I will say one thing, that maybe Martin Luther King had this in mind in 1964, I believe it was, when he was talking about a certain piece of legislation that was going to be passed, or that we wanted to be passed, and it was a little bit in doubt at the time. And he said, one thing about this civil rights law, I have to admit to my critics, it can't make my neighbor love me, but it can keep him maybe from killing me. And the real truth behind that little quip is all the business about love and good, and I find this to be a problem in my own life, really means nothing if a man's life isn't preserved. There is finally, in that sense, for each organism, you might say, immediate good for him, and that is the preservation of his life. And of course, we're talking about a good deal more than just keeping people alive. There is, of course, in life, the possibility of just almost atomic existence, just moment-to-moment breathing and respiration, or the taking in of nourishment and expulsion of waste product. This isn't the final definition of life, although it's basic, perhaps. By life, we mean the expansion and the growth and the development of all aspects of the organism, everything. So that a crime or an evil against life might be a crime against, if you will, the feelings of man. It might be the prevention because of scarcity or lack or overlooking or not caring of the opportunity for the development of a child's mind, so that it is more selfish than simply biological. Okay, I think that's enough to start off with. Now then we can go on from there. And you're killing bugs over there, and that's a great sin. Yes. Well, I guess you can defend yourself.
Did I understand this, the final definition of good for a person when his life is expanding and then when it's contracting, that this is evil no matter?
I suppose that's a way of putting it, and of course ultimately the expansion of human life, the life that we live and we believe at least at this point is the highest expression, is of course to find this unity with God. It is the inner driving aim in man. Thou hast made us for thyself. Our heart is rested, so it rests in thee. Same question.
Well, if a person got to the point then when he couldn't expand his life anymore, this would be the proper time for it to be terminated, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, that's a question. That's a delightful question. In Japanese religions, of course, such things have actually happened. You have reached the ecstasy of the aegis. I kind of think this is a pseudo question because life just never does stop expanding if it's free. Yes?
I'd like to pin you down a little more on the definition of good factor.
Sure.
Would you say that according to your definition of good, it would be possible to do a good act without that act also being a virtuous act?
And you want to bring virtue in here, and now we get to the law and everything. If you're going to bring virtue in, and which is morality, then you have to talk about volition and will, don't you? Mm-hmm. There is no way that you can discuss morality without discussing will, and then devolving back again to the problem which we touched on the other day of freedom. The definition, the general, kind of, and really general and non-specific idea of good that I promulgated to you this morning, I think you could probably consider certain acts that would be not covered by morality in that sense. Yes, you would have to, because biological and natural processes are included, you see. Morality or virtue becomes an issue and becomes possible only at a certain dimensionality of development in human beings, as far as we know, where they have the decisiveness to be able to say yes and no, or maybe, and to respond in certain ways. Now, there are many, many ways of looking at virtue or morality. I've always thought that Kant was at least right to the point that he says no act is a virtuous or moral act unless it is done out of a good will, that is, out of benevolence, purely good intention, so to speak. I think that you can carry that too far, though, because he then defined most everything that I've included in my general description, as well as most of the things we consider as being good and bad in that sense in human life, out of morality, because it specifically became doing your duty. But he was not wrong when he laid the essence of morality to volition, to a good will. And of course, in this, he was probably being fairly faithful to the terms of Jesus, that Jesus laid a major stress on the attention of the heart, on the goodness or the misdirectness of the will. I tell you, he who looks lustfully after a woman has already been adulterous. So I would have to answer yes, you know. But there is good, and let me just, because it sounds awfully silly to say there can be good which isn't moral, but there is good in the universe outside the bounds of what we consider virtue or morality. Simply because when we look at it more carefully, virtue or morality becomes present in light only at this certain stage of men with this power. The other forms, the animals and flowers, participate in good too. I don't know if that's satisfactory.
Good and evil, he doesn't like to use those terms.
Sure, but don't blame
him. He said, he talked about relativity of I guess he might have been talking about morality too, and involved in that. This is the relative one, that you can say that killing people in situations is good, and because of the. And he talked about sin and capital S and
almost a month ago we had a discussion late one night right in this room about war. At least it was going to be about war. I thought it turned out to be a short course in systematic theology or something. But we came down to the call. And when you say relatively speaking, of course, then we're in the area of our practical life together, where we have to deal according to our lights, that we're not as mature, we're not as intelligent as maybe as we might be and so forth, and we don't see all angles. And we were trying to pin a certain young man down here down on this matter of pacifism, which would come in. And we just brought up a very stupid example for Holden Village, at least I hope it is, that a maniac runs in and starts, you know, cutting down all the participants here around the fire. And this particular young man is also in this problem given a gun. He has a loaded pistol there and not blind or anything. The man's just on the other side of the room. Indeed, he's chopping down the boy's sister at this point. And now the question is, would it be a good thing, you know, to shoot him? Well, now, I really think that with a more a general, non-specific, but a very general conception of good coming out of the ancient tradition and being ultimately unconsciously present even in our discussion of relative good, we might make some kind of sense out of it. And it becomes a question, I think, of measure and decision then as to what ultimately is preservative of life and preservative of all aspects of life. It's a question not of really good at all, but of lesser forms of evil. Mm-hmm. Actually. And I suppose this is rather hard for me to say, because I would like to be a consistent pastor, but I'm not. That I would think that it would be better, and I'll use your term and yours, Paul, better to shoot that maniac at that point. Yes?
Well, would you say then that good is an ultimate, and that anything less than this is lesser or greater forms of evil, or would you say that there can be lesser and greater forms of good?
I think we'd have to say, and not just myself, but we would just simply have to say that there are lesser forms of good. For the simple reason, now, and this is the whole other side of this that I hadn't mentioned, I think we did mention last hour, if I'm not mistaken, that evil then is non-being. Evil mm-hmm. is nothing. Evil is lack of good. It in itself is not a power. evil is a deficiency of good. In the moral sphere, it would be the defect of not having a good will. You will, because we know men will and do many things. We talk about how, you know, Al Capone loves his grandmother and sort of thing. It isn't that these actions are themselves good and evil. That's obviously evil. That's a sin against love. It's a lack. It's less than desirable. It'd be much more desirable if I could think about the whole. But again, you know, we're limited. I couldn't do that and even try to sit here. There are deficiencies of good in the world. St. Augustine spelled this out for the Christian tradition at some length, showing that it is our closedness to the attractive power of God's goodness, our closedness, that we will not, that is productive of all the events and the activities in the world that we call out of any evil. And then this ties in with something we talked about the first hour, which maybe make a little more sense now, that the real problem of evil comes into being in its heightened form in a monotheistic system. In a system that religiously will confess one God, or philosophically speaks about a unitary source out of which all things spring, or by which they are to be explained. Then you've got this problem. In a dualistic system, it doesn't change the world, but at least it's more amenable to reason, perhaps, to talk about conflict between two ultimate powers. Christianity cannot do this, although on the popular level, and indeed on the theological and philosophical level, sometimes it's talked this way, and sometimes we talk this way, as if there were this power of death and hell and sin and everything, almost, that it was as great as God or greater. And of course it is not. Not at least according to the traditional representatives that underlie our creeds. Yes, sir.
If you're trying to get this straight, I didn't. Evil is being close to God, is that right?
That's one way of talking about it. Evil is less than the full good realizable at any moment in our life.
Well, I was trying to relate this to this example that you had about a month ago, this maniac coming in.
Yeah.
Now, it's quite possible he might be close to God. On the other hand, it could be just be the chemical reactions that have gone wrong within his body.
That's a very, very good point. And I don't see that there's a problem, though. That's a very good point, but I don't see that there's a problem.
John, I try a hypothetical on you that your lawyers like to use to torture themselves.
Yeah.
There are a number of cases that fit this pattern, but we lump it under what we call the case of a Splunk and Explorer.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Go ahead.
It involves essentially a Splunkers that are people who go down into caverns to explore them. And they take with them a telephone wire so they can communicate with the outside. When they're in the cave down deep, they have an earthquake causing the entryway to be sealed off. It doesn't destroy them. There are underground bodies of water, so they have enough to drink, and there's plenty of air seeping through the cracks, so they aren't about to suffocate. They are in contact with the outside through the telephone wire. They can also be used to drive certain amount of lights. Control that way. And they ask the people on the outside whether or not the entryway can be cleared, and they are sure that it can be. It simply is an engineering problem and they take a little time. That's all. They bring in engineers to find out how long. And it seems that it'll take about a month. And they then call in the people who are good in medical sciences and ask them how long they can live without food, because that's the problem.
And they
cannot live long. Otherwise, they have no particular problem. So they call the clergyman and ask the clergyman, will it be all right for us to draw lots now? And the guy who gets the short straw gets killed. We all agree with this. The way these cases have happened in real life,
shipwreck.
These are the only ones we know of, yes. What has happened in real life is that everybody agrees and they draw straws, and then the guy who gets the short straw says, I just decided that I don't want to be part of this. But the guy, no. But the case that we pose for ourselves is before the killing occurs, the people on the lower end of the telephone wire call the clergyman, they call the lawyers, and so forth. So may we go through with this? We got the guy down here, we're sitting on him, we're about to bash his head in. It was a fair and square draw. He agreed in advance. But we don't want to be met the way that the law has always met the people who have done this on ships and be executed at the time that we come out of the cave. Because that's what's always happened in the law. The survivors have always been hanged from the yardarm until ship because they commit murder by the law, the rule.
I wouldn't be like an officer to be around. Can you do that if you don't say it? I wonder, you know, this is of course every other textbook somewhere or another has a shipwreck case.
Yeah.
I've not met it in a book that I can remember of the sea authors, but that has the benefit of covering a lot of loose ends, as you say.
I wonder if it isn't amenable, if we have to have meaning in life. And that seems to me to be a prerequisite of being human.
The nice thing about the case, obviously, and you're just saying this for alignment, if I may, is that these people are at a point where they are going to have to make a decision.
That's
they're
right.
Either going to have to choose to starve or they're going to have to choose.
And that the loopholes, which are prior acquaintance with such things in history, have been closed.
Right.
This is kind of right down to
been able to say that they would have survived and voted, you know,
right,
because they're
right.
Picked up a little
fish or something like that. That's right. Okay, and also because now you've dragged the law and the church into it. let me say this, that I really believe that this one's an insoluble one, and that's why every ethics textbook likes to use it. Unless you do have some sort of a general overarching view of the good, and that it has something specifically to say about life and a quality of life, I would give you my answer immediately that they would be ethically justified. And the ethical justification would be very utilitarian, I suppose, the greater good, you know, for the greater number. And that, of course, is subject to a good deal of demonic distortion. Indeed, it has been a reason given for a good many things that ultimately show themselves up as maybe being far from good. But with an overarching view that visualizes man as having a goal or an aim, and that this goal and aim includes the fulfillment of himself, I think we can handle it. In fact, I would go and make another stupid statement. The first one was that I think that they're ethically justified. The second is I think really a Christian culture can deal with this problem better than any other. Because what you have here, it's defective in your legal terminology now at the point that the man wanted to back out. And if I can believe some of the stories I've read, there have been occasions when this was not the case. It's defective because the man then wants to change his mind. But one might also consider this as being a case of self-sacrifice. And of sacrifice.
I have a lot less trouble with suicide.
Yeah.
That's a legal problem.
Right.
We were met then on the cannibalism, and we can get over that a lot.
Yeah. I believe it was out here in the West someplace that the only trial for cannibalism in American history was ever held, wasn't it?
Colorado
someplace.
Yeah. And the problem there was that the Indian guy killed these people.
Yeah.
Was told by the judge, so the story goes, that there were only five Democrats in Colorado, or five Republicans.
And he ate four of them.
He ate four of them.
Yeah, I remember that very well.
The judge was a fish.
That was pretty rough. But let me say that there are some analogies, except for the defectiveness now of the testimony at the point where the man, again, rather naturally, we might say, wanted to bug out when they were on him with the rock. But there are analogies to the kinds of cases for which I think, and properly so, we give the nation's highest medals of soldiers who throw themselves upon bombs and hand grenades and such, or stand in the way of bullets to preserve their comrades. With the exception of the fact that in most cases they don't eat the bodies, I don't see a difference there. Now, pretty obviously,
The difference lies in this, that we now have a segment of our society which is asking us to advise. And we are met in a place where it's impossible, and we must either advise them or we must abdicate our mutual responsibilities as whatever group we have directed.
That's right.
Lutheran Church or the law or whatever.
I quite agree with you.
And I don't see how one can avoid the necessity of saying, I hereby advise you to kill the man, or I hereby advise you to start with him. Unless you do it as one young man, who can be one, and say, I hereby advise you, each of you take one leg. There are counter problems with that, too.
Yeah. I'm sorry it has the defect of the man backing out in it. Life has this complication, and I'm sure that your rendition would be closer to something that might happen than mine, but if the man indeed were of such a noble character that he did not back out, I don't think we would have a real problem, as revolting as the whole conception is, you know, to us in our normal life. Did you want to say something about Pope Man?
Well, I wonder, this example is a good one to argue about, but it is fairly remote from the experience of most of us.
Yeah, I wonder about a half a dozen kids.
Yeah. It might have some analogies, though.
I wonder if abortion, the problem of abortion, doesn't begin to provide an analogy. We're drifting, drifting pretty rapidly in certain directions that I think are questionable. Mm-hmm. But we are, at one time, you know, we were just, life is sacred, the sanctity of life, so
it
we
is.
Assume that life begins at the moment of conception, mm-hmm. and therefore there's no abortion. But why not? One doctor argued, well, you see, in some cases like rubella, you don't know whether the child is going to be injured, or the thalidomide cases. Why not wait and see until the child is born?
And
if the child is then born, and you see it's all crippled and will have a deformed life, then you put it out of the way. And everyone, people are just horrified at that. But we appear to we're dropping in our society the notion, or at least it's losing this real seriousness, that life is sacred at any point after conception. We don't think that's just good, because we're now allowing abortions in the event of, when there's a substantial danger that the mother's health will be damaged, and health is being included, includes mental health, and mental health
that's
includes
right.
happiness, and it
yeah.
could come to the point to know where she's not going to get a new car because of this baby, okay, put it out of the way. Now, I wonder here, what principles we are using, and your sanctity of life, the flowering.
Yes.
I wonder if it gives us any guide. I don't think it does.
I don't think it does, unless, of course, it comes up against the hard problems of life, such as at least are symbolized by his remote example, and are better symbolized by your examples, perhaps, of abortion, because certainly this is something that happens, number-wise, a good deal. I think then here, we must understand that life is not to be understood purely biologically, which I did say and didn't say very clearly, but that it includes the mental and the spiritual and whatever other dimensions personality may be capable of exhibiting. Now, in the case of abortions under the thalidomide business and this sort of thing, I would think definitely there, any courts, and I believe courts in some countries, if not in ours, have held that such abortions were permissible. Their reasoning must have gone along a line like this. As far as we know, such a defective child with flippers could be born and biologically survive. At least some have done so. This is how it came to our attention in Germany, I believe, that this was the case. So that the biological aspect of life, its primary, its basic one, to be very sure, is not questionable. It must be other aspects of life. It must be the chance, and it is only a chance in any one of us, let's be very fair about that an intelligent mind might flower, that a spirit might develop and grow, that the individual to be so born might make contributions to society in small and at large, which is also part of life, that he might be able to appreciate and to enjoy the contributions made by others and so forth, so that it obviously has to be less specific than the biological and include all these things to come in. Now, at this point, I would think that I'm trying to weasel out, obviously, you have to when you get nailed down on these things. That's the reason we bring them up. Yep. And it's a good reason, because if it won't bear at this point, no theory will bear really at any other point. It's just a question of words and overawing one another with facts or vast theories and so forth. At this point, then, we have to take into account that each one of us is also an expression of such life and of such development to a certain stage. And that part of that development indeed includes our minds, and it includes that which we have been able to learn and discover and to piece together, and we call science and we call knowledge. Some of this knowledge is medical, other is legal, other is ethical. They are not dissimilar. They merely approach the problem from various tacks. Part of the medical knowledge might be that this child will be a vegetable, and we know this because children have been born in this way, and that as far as we're able to tell, although I suppose anyone who's visited mental institutions and seen such individuals wonders to himself what is really going on inside that organism. But as far as our science can tell, that it is not what we would call full human life, or consider a fully developed person, that this part has to be foregone if the child is allowed to live. Another and a much clearer thing I would think would come into being where the pregnancy may bring up chances again on the basis of the experience that underlies medical science, chances that the mother's life, which we have demonstrably before us, has developed to a certain point, might be in danger. So these kinds of things would have to be taken into account. I don't know. For my own part, this thing hits me pretty deeply, and I find it difficult to be able to say. I'm glad I'm not a judge or a lawyer or a medical man at this point, you know, that this life ought to be permanent. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say that it seems to me that there's another way of looking at things. Maybe I should say I'm acting kind of defensive now. I'm the author of a bill to provide for abortion, almost free choice in the state of Washington, which I hope will be introduced into the legislature, and I'll do my best to have it enacted. I'm an anti-abortionist. I don't think that we ought to resort to abortion. However, one is occasionally forced to choices that you cannot avoid. I'm thinking, for example, that we have a situation in our society where a young woman was in my office 2 weeks ago saying she had a real hard time finding an abortionist in Seattle recently because of the crackdown we've had. And finally, she went to the police and asked for a referral to the best abortionist that they were still permitted to operate, and they gave her a referral and she had the abortion. And she wanted to pass the information on to me. And in the event somebody else was coming and looking for the information, I would know where to send them. This I use as an illustration of the fact that we say we have a choice. There either will be abortions or there will not be abortions. This is not true. Our choice is, are we going to have a particular kind of abortion, or are we going to have another system of abortion? I hate abortion. I hate addiction to alcohol. I hate deaths on the highway. I hate poverty. I hate anything that injures human life. But I think we quite deceive ourselves if we think that it's a different, qualitatively different thing to starve a person to death at the age of 40 in a slum than it is to eradicate a life before it's born. And to say that life is sacred and therefore we won't deliberately kill is to blind our eyes to the fact that although we say we have technological capacity to do things, for example, feed everyone, we do not have that capacity if we can't do it.
And if we cannot structure ourselves in such a way that we can deliver, as long as it's true, for example, that the United States, with our massive knowledge about medical care, still is, what, 14, 15, 16, 17,000 at the top on infant mortality, as long as we permit mothers and children to die in gross numbers within walking distance of hospitals that could be utilized for this purpose, we deceive ourselves if we say that we're talking about an actual choice. And what we must do is face a very real and realistic question of living in a world of imperfection where we are going to let some people die, where we're going to let some people starve, where we are going to place some people in filthy institutions, where we are going to kill other people on bulges and floating bridges that can be taken out. Just a certain amount of money invested because we have the theoretical technological capacity to do it, and all we have to do is divide the number of bucks it would cost for the number of deaths that occur the given year on that pool bullet, and you know what Seattle thinks of human life is worth. Now, faced with this kind of reality, see, must we not simply say to ourselves, we're not talking about good or evil in terms of absolutes. We are talking about better or poorer forms of social organization.
I agree with you on this, Frank.
Comes closer or further away from hitting the mark that we would like to go after.
You illustrate what, I don't know if I read this poem the other day here or not or somewhere else, but Arthur Hugh Clough has a poem called the Revived Decalogue or something like that. He says, thou shalt not kill, but need not strive officiously to keep alive.
Right.
But you're also illustrating what Luther in his discussion of the commandment about murder begins in the positive note, that we indeed have the obligation to preserve all forms of life and every aspect of it.
But his advice with reference to the deformed or abnormal child was to drown.
Was it really? Thank God it's not in the catechism.
Any table talk, he says this child is obviously possessed by a devil, therefore destroyed by drowning.
Again, we've got to stop and think about development in that case, not to defend 450 years. We had this hand first. And
I'd like to try one more quick dilemma here when I turn my question to speak here. Suppose that you had a chemical which, if added to drinking water, would, out of every 100,000 people, save, let's say, 100, who otherwise would die of some disease, but at the same time would be toxic for 10 and kill them. If you think this is far-fetched, of course, just mention penicillin or aspirin or any chemical.
Sounds like the fluoride.
Yeah.
Well, no, any new chemical invention will have the same, not the same. Are you justified in adding it? I mean, you really believe the greatest good for the greatest number. Justified in adding it.
I would think a case like that, I would very gladly defer to the lawyer, but I would have to say this.
You justified in killing a great number?
No. I think the problem
that... You have no choice. You're either going to kill one or kill a thousand. You take your choice.
You're not killing them.
You're not preserving them.
No.
But we're overlooking one thing.
You're killing them because you have the capacity to preserve.
But we're overlooking one thing yet. When you're talking about something that's done on a social scale now, you're also talking about something to which all members of a society ought to make a contribution, part of the decision. Although it will be certainly true that the magistrates or the administration finally, ultimately, would have to sign a bill or not, yet, at least in the kinds of a society, we would think that the values that we've probably talked about this morning would be somewhat democratic. You'd be jumping a stage. If you would jump the referendum stage, I mean, obviously this is symbolic for the fact that all parts of a society would have to be involved in a decision like that. And I'm sure that you're both right that such things are not so foreign to human life, and if you could believe this propaganda that's put out against fluoride, it's even worse than that.
Penicillin, though, John, has the same.
It has the reaction.
I mean, it's invaluable for human life, but it also has taken life.
Well, you can think of the day that they opened the wrong gates in the Grand Coulee Dam, so that they let the water in, the upper end, before they opened the gates and let it go out. There were people returning the tunnel. The choice is, slam the thing, drown the people in the tunnel, or else wash out the dam and kill everybody in the temple. You got the button, you either kill 16 men or run a very grave risk of wiping out a couple hundred people. Take the choice. If it isn't, you have a choice not to kill.
No.
That's which you want.
And at that point, I don't think there's much doubt about what we'll do.
That's still a slightly different because we're going to turn it around.
Well, you could ignore it and say, this is out of my hands. I didn't start.
That's right. That you can't wash your hands of. You either press the button or you don't. So well, if you have this chemical.
You're standing by the button. You didn't open the floodgates. And we do this, you see, in our law all the time. I'm walking down the street and there's an instant line face down in the puddle. I have no legal obligation to pick it up. I didn't put it there. I'm not responsible for its life. Therefore, I walk by and let the kid drown. It's tough luck. I didn't do it.
Then we need a law as France has. Something that they have.
In Europe, which is a civil law system, you've got to pick it up or else be criminally liable. Liable for it. Then you see, following that same principle, you've got to press that button.
But you still have to have the chemical. You're not killing anybody with the dog.
Well, I think we're just shifting our facts a little bit now. Yeah. I can fact the case back to where you've got the chemical and you can preserve life. And the law didn't say you must do it. You must exercise that capacity that you have preserved. In the jingle that you use, our law says, thou shalt not kill. In Europe it says, thou shalt strive
to preserve life.
In the United States we do not. We say thou needs not strive to preserve life.
It would be all right to not do it in the United States.
Yeah.
Well, I love it here.
I wonder whether I'm glad or not.
Well,
was it your hand?
Yes.
And the gentleman back here, Paul, and
I think all this illustrates the danger now of taking the approach that you've been taking today. While it is very useful, or can be useful, to talk about the good, insofar as it helps us to make rational choices between better and worse situations, it's dangerous in that it encourages us to suppose that we can somehow get a handle on the good. And when we do this, then we also begin using words like cropped up a moment ago, justified. And I feel that here is where the demonic enters in. When we suppose that we can, in this hard world where it is impossible to choose the good, and incidentally impossible to choose the evil too, that we can somehow be justified if we take this course, if we use this definition of the good, if we cultivate this attitude or this sensitivity or anything else, that we can then pursue the good. I think that is when we become actually demonic.
Now, when you use the word justify, of course, be similar to rationalization or something here, and I think that you're exactly right. On the other hand, Paul, I'd point out something that you, I know quite well aware of. Some such conception of the good or some other overarching theory of the good will be unconsciously and immaturely present in our mind in our making of the utilitarian choices, whether we think about it or not.
That's why I say it's useful insofar as
one must have the overarching view, and particularly in theology, because again, someone has asked again and again, I noticed in the lectures and the discussions around here, how does this tie into God? You see? And I think you have too.
It ties in. And I think it ties in very directly. Because you see, I do not believe that you can make the significance of life some kind of absolute criterion of the good. No matter how broadly you define life, the ground of the good is God. And we use the term God to refer to that which is the ground of our ineradicable confidence in the significance of life. And that is something we can never get a hold of. We do. When someone says life is, when you start talking, as you did at the beginning, about the sacredness of life and the development and flowering of life, we think we know what you mean. Mm-hmm. We agree with this. But yet we can't get a handle on this. As soon as we try to get a handle on it, we begin setting up rules that mm-hmm. cause us to disrespect not so much life as that which is the ground of our confidence in life, which I call God.
To get a handle on, of course, you're using this vaguely and determinately, so for the sake of argument, I'd have to admit and certainly be the first one to say we don't get a handle on things. It is all through a veil darkly, if you will. But yet, ultimately, it does give us some confidence to continue to live, to endure, if you will. And for my part, I would wonder what other thread, if you will, leading forward or leading back from this meaningfulness we refer to as God, we would use if it were not life. I'm sure there must be alternatives, but I wonder if they all would not presuppose this, or else be pretty completely irrational, or more sunk into a deficiency of good if they did not revolve about this. Just as a little illustration of what you are correctly pointing out, if that button were on the border between France and Germany, and there were German miners on one end and French dignitaries on the other, there would be another problem involved as to the character of the man who was standing there with the button. You know, such things have happened before. Again, because good, in the relative world in which we live, tends to get crystallized into things, you know, like our nation and our people and things of this nature. But I want these men to be able to speak now.
I would just like to express a hang-up that I have in regard to the business of choosing good and looking on good as, or not good, as something that deters or prevents full expression of life, broadening and the advance of life in the broad term, not just biologic life. And that is the other end of the life span, when we have somebody who is a vegetable, being preserved in an institution, using up tax money.
Whenever you get the man on the life raft or speed offers now and you get abortion, you can lay his neck. And quite so, because we have to test things at their crisis point. And I'll repeat again, although it may hurt the case that I present it to you, but it's certainly true, as Whitehead and every other philosopher has recognized, that if there is one point at which a thesis will not hold, then it will not really hold any. In the case of euthanasia and the terminus of life now, I think it more specifically related to most of us than to the vegetable in the asylum would be the extremely aged person who is held in the bonds of something they might call life by all of these advanced medical techniques. And this is something I think that every family probably has had to face to a degree, and I would think is going to have to face now, since all of us live longer on the average, and it will even perhaps involve some of us. My own particular opinion, I don't know if I could expose all the reason, I'm sure I couldn't within, without an hour or two, is that this is a little different case, in fact considerably different from the abortive one, because we're here faced with the fact of life, of a life that has endured. And I don't know here, for example, the arguments about the life of the mother, for example, the arguments about what will be the upshot if the pregnancy is terminated in a live birth, is such that in the abortion argument, and none of these things are to the point here. I believe that in the Christian tradition, usefulness cannot be taken as a criteria of the sanctity of life. If it were, God forbid, most of us would not be worth our being taught, let's face it. So I don't think usefulness or utility at this point is a very good maxim to follow, unless it were a case, again, you had a critical situation, let us say, here is starvation or something, and here is some aged person kept alive by machines, and here are a lot of other people with more chance to live and develop and contribute and so forth. You could manufacture, indeed such cases could come into being. All we need is a flood or an earthquake or a war or something and manufacture such real life situations. But apart from that, I don't think any of this reasoning would hold. The question about what death is, I'm sure, and there are medical men sitting here better qualified than I to speak on this, but I'm relatively sure that medically and legally there are varying ideas about this when physical death occurs. And from my own...
we don't have to worry. We just wait a little while and then it comes out.
Wait a little while, right. unfortunately, the doctor, you know, gets there before the lawyer, so he's the one that has to carry it out. In my own part-time experience as a minister and visiting in tuberculosis sanitariums and homes for the aged and so forth, I have had my most serious doubts about whether this was a simulacrum, just simply a supposed life or not, with the machines and so forth. And again, here I would say we would have to defer to that part of the intellect and that part of the spirit that has developed itself along the lines of experience and what can be known factually about life and its processes and so forth, that is to the medical profession and to the associated profession on that. But to use utility, and here I'd go back against the maxims that I followed in other forces. I don't think we can use utility as a basis. I don't think even the fact that this is costing lots and lots of money can be used as an argument, personally, about this.
Yes. This morning, we heard Reiki speak about the need for law in our language as a means of regulating human relationships. And then we hear John Cooper speak in terms of what is good. And one of the current issues that brings these two points together very dramatically, I think, is the fact that our national body of our Lutheran Church in America has recently indicated that they believe that in the current Vietnam conflict, that individuals should have the right to become a SEAL, a conscientious objector, for a specific war. And yet there is no support for this stand in terms of the law of the land. Current law doesn't allow this. You cannot be a conscientious objector to a specific war. So that we have a great dilemma here. If you follow the church's dictum here, you could say, I will become a CO for this specific Vietnam war, but then you will end up in jail because you cannot be a conscientious objector for a specific war, as the law says, you can't. And to break the law is pretty serious business too, because I feel that it's essential and that this current situation is really drawing us into a tremendous problem.
Well, I would think here there would be, if you want to ask this now as an ethical question, which of course it is, the legal thing really isn't in doubt, as you've mentioned. Now there may be, and indeed there are plenty of legislators and lawyers and intelligent people of all kinds that have some power and may change that law. I would not be surprised to see in some future time the law change. It obviously is not changed now and probably won't be under the the impress of a shooting war going on. And it would be well nigh incomprehensible to me that we could get such legislation on a national scale right now. Frankly, I'll have to say I would think that such legislation would be justified. Now why? And to the problem that you raised. First, let us say that if the American Lutheran Church or other churches have made such statements about conscience, because this is the sphere as murky as the sphere of conscience is, this is what it refers to. It would not be the first time in history by any means that the church has said one thing and the law of a particular land has said another. And with all due respect to the law by which we must live and must have as human beings, the law as it exists cannot be taken as a touchstone for what is Christian morality or ethics. In this case now, I would think, and I haven't read that document, I've heard it discussed, and particularly this at Holden Village, I would think that document is probably falling back, at least theologically, upon the tradition, which we have the Thomistic tradition in the Catholic Church, which although it may have a lot that it shouldn't have in it, has a lot of things that are quite useful and helpful. That in a moot point like this, each person is left to his own conscience. And in a sense, my understanding of the upshot of the ALC document is precisely that. That we are not binding you under a dictum. In other words, we cannot really rationally and theologically give you an answer and say, if you're a Lutheran, we're bound to this or not. But that this is indeed a disputed question. This is one that's immature. It's unformed. Obviously it is, because it's a very recent thing. We haven't had time to live with it. We haven't had time to deal with it. And that we're telling you now, if you decide in this way, let us say, to stand against the law of the land, well, you obviously are going to have to take your consequences. But that at the same time, it's a matter of dispute. There seem to be some weight on both sides of the issue, and therefore we can't bind you. At least I hope that document is read that way.
Yes. It's not all that bleak. I think part of the reason for the passing of that law is to give the weight to the church, to beg and to students who
really have a conscience.
I know, in fact, in a couple of cases where students had they applied before this came up with the old status, because the religion would not have gotten it, but now have. So that the government will now have to recognize that the Lutheran Church recognizes conscious objection in certain cases, and therefore Lutheran students will find it easy.
You mean recognize a specific conscientious objection? As over against general conscientious objection,
that's
which
right.
Is indeed the law of our country, as well as the position of our church since the First World War, when it first became a very major issue.
So it's been very difficult for students to register a field if they were not going to make it quicker or something else. And now it is easier for Lutheran students to do this since that rule, mm-hmm. part of the church.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very treacherous problem about which I know almost nothing. Yes, sir.
Well, the Oxford Confession, which is one of our basic documents, has stated from the beginning that a Christian may engage in just wars.
Yeah.
It places the problem on his conscience. It's been there all the time. Though in the cradle of Lutheranism, this wasn't accepted. Practically speaking, he was a subject of the state, and he would do what the state commanded him to do. And he was taught to do this as a matter of conscience. And he forgot what was in the Oxford Confession. Or even in the history of the church, where though a Christian was commanded to keep silence, he said, "I must obey God rather than men."
Well, I want to dispute this interpretation of the Oxford Confession. I think that the phrase "just war" is used in the Oxford Confession has to be defined in terms of what they meant at those times by a just war. So it's not defined in the Augsburg Confession. It is pretty well defined in the Formula of Concord.
Mm-hmm.
And a just war does not mean a war that the individual Christian in his conscience decides is just. It means a war fought for limited ends with limited means.
Yes, and generally a defensive war.
So what is it?
Yeah,
well,
the problem still remains.
Yeah, the clear implication of the discussion of this period about just war, the long history of the doctrine of just war, is, I think, that the Christian does not have to bother himself about deciding whether a particular war is just or not. He can just go ahead and do it.